Hey guys, this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palate comes with a special gift. Right now, for my listeners, we are offering a 50% off discount on your annual subscription to Somm TV. So go to SommTV.com right now, sign up for an annual membership, use code, wait for it, Shakera, S-H-A-K-E-R-A, for 50% off your annual subscription. That way you won't miss any episodes of any of the amazing shows, including mine, on the Somm TV streaming platform. Go sign up now. What's up, guys? Welcome to this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palate. Wow, this season has just been like dope guest after dope guest. Actually, all two seasons of the podcast has been that. But today is particularly special because I think that maybe a week before I knew I was starting this, I tried to get this guest on. But he is one of the busiest people I've ever encountered in life. And I think that I'm busy. But the theme of today's show is going to be adaptability. And today's guest is somebody that, I mean, if adaptable was a person, it would be him. He is one of two, well, three maybe. Is it two or three? It's two or three current Black Master Sommeliers. He has, if you were in wine, you knew him, but I think that he's been thrusted to the forefront where like everyone knows his name now. An organizer, a community builder, a true hospitality professional, an inspiration, a motivator. Carlton McCoy. Hey, Carlton.
Hey, hey, how are you?
I'm good. Someone's going to yell at me for banging on the desk like that, but I really had to find my words. See? To make sure that we did an adequate introduction of you. I'm so glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And so happy. We've got a long career to talk about. So let's go, let's begin before the grand awakening, as I like to call it.
Sure, sure.
Let's start with Carlton deciding that hospitality is going to be a profession for him. So you did not grow up out west in California or in Napa. You had a very, very cool and interesting upbringing. So let's start there. Let's start with how does young Carlton decide this is going to be a career for him?
Sure, sure. So I was fortunate enough to get I got a scholarship to go to culinary school, and which I think was, I wasn't expecting to go to college. My family wasn't expecting me to go to college. I was sort of a screw up kid in high school. I had a lot of problems, a lot of emotional issues from some situations growing up. And like most kids in the inner city, when those issues aren't dealt with, you act out, you know, you sort of give up on a lot of things. And that's what I did. But I was really fortunate enough to be approached by a program called CCAP, which is actually based out of New York. Richard Grossman started it. It's an incredible program. And they helped me get a scholarship to the CIA. So I went to be a cook. I grew up cooking. Mm-hmm. Still literally one of my favorite things in the world to do is to cook. And that's what I was going to do with my life. And I was really blessed to have that opportunity. And I took it very seriously. I went to the CIA and just sort of, that was my world. That's all I did was I studied cookbooks. You know, I would be on the Metro North back and forth between CIA and New York every weekend, staging at whatever restaurant would have me, you know, and that's what I did. And then I moved to New York. And, you know, my grandmother, who was pretty much my only parent, passed away very shortly after I graduated from college. So it was a very tumultuous time. And, you know, I wasn't raised in a family that had, you know, means to support me. I actually jumped into the dining room to help support my sister and her kids. Mm. And that was really difficult for me because I love cooking and I love the kitchen, the energy of it, everything about it. Even it's a very difficult career, but I still loved it. So that was difficult, but you know, it was what I needed to do to support my family.
So you moved your family when you finished culinary school, you went back to, you're originally from Philly, right?
I'm from DC.
From DC, sorry.
Yeah.
Did you go back to DC?
No, I moved to Manhattan first.
Okay.
And I moved to Manhattan to cook. And I was in Manhattan for a few months and my grandmother died. So that took a really quick turn where it was like, okay, this is the plan you had, but this thing in life happened. And, you know, it's like, you don't get to decide anymore. You know, the world decided for you. There's a certain amount of money you must make, right?
Yes.
It's not about what you want to do at that point. It's like, you know, my sister was really struggling with, you know, trying to raise two kids. She had two kids when she was very young. And my sister and I are very close. So I had to take a job to help support her. And so I got a job working at Kraft Steak. It was my first front of the house job. It was back when like the meatpacking district had just blown up, like more Motors, Del Posto, like they all opened at the same time. And I opened it. That environment was really crazy. I really liked Calico, like as food, but it was a very young management team and it was just a really tough environment. So I only worked there for a few months because I got an opportunity to interview actually a per se. And I was very underqualified for the job. You know, I interviewed, but what they liked was that one, I had a work ethic and I knew a lot about food, which was as a food runner in that restaurant, you know, having someone who's a culinary grad is like a dream. So I got the job and that was really like finishing school for me. It taught me service in a really, really high-end environment, how to present yourself, how to speak, the steps of service, how to do it quickly, how to, you know, it was a really great experience, very difficult environment to work in, super demanding, but it was sort of like what set the tone for the trajectory of the rest of my career in the service industry.
You know, I love that you brought up a point of like how many times, especially for inner city and underprivileged people, you know, you have this idea of what you want to be, but the older you get and the more life happens and the more outside influence you have, like pursuing passion is a privilege.
It's an absolute privilege.
It's an absolute privilege. And I'm so glad that you brought that up because, you know, as we're in this time now where we're talking about opening spaces and you know, creating a world that's more inclusive, a part of inclusivity is, you know, can I live off this?
Can
I make this a living? You know, and we have it in so many other fields. You know, you have politicians saying, well, I was a waiter and I paid my way through law school. Yeah, well, no one can do that now because there is nowhere that you could work where you would ever make enough money as a server to go to law school in America.
Correct. And not actually have time to go to law school.
Yeah, you wouldn't. You'd literally have to work like 20 hours a week at multiple jobs to be able to afford one credit at most law schools.
Yeah.
And so I think that's important to mention. And then you talk about, you know, how being at Persa honed like specific things, that how to present yourself and all of that. Mm-hmm. As you think about that experience and how you see the world now through a lens, like the buzz topics that we're all talking about is authenticity and showing up at your true self. Yeah. Personally, I believe that you can do both. You can be authentically yourself. And also, I feel like in any given time or space, we all wear masks that make us different people for whatever the occasion calls for.
Everybody does it.
Exactly. And I think that it's looked upon in minority groups as a very bad thing, and it's not viewed the same way among others. So how do you feel about that?
I think, look, this is the thing is, when you live in a world that has conspired to associate your culture with a lack of intelligence and poverty, it's an actual effort that has been made in society, in media. They capitalize on this disinformation campaign to associate African-American culture, which is copied all around the world. I travel all around the world. It is the most copied culture in the world.
Yes.
And they associate it with poverty only when it's the person of color who is actually expressing themselves, right? This is appropriation, right? Then obviously then, you know, you're dealing with this complex of no one should ever be ashamed of being a part of such a beautiful culture. But when the world tries to make you ashamed of the person that you are while simultaneously robbing your culture and putting their own name on it, it's a very difficult psychological issue to sort of cope with. And while, you know, everyone else does it in the world, right? Like, you know, my friends who are Asian American, you know, at home, they speak a different language, they cook different food, they act differently, the whole thing, but then they go out into the world because it's also a pretty selfless act to understand the fact that we should adjust ourselves sometimes to make other people comfortable, because I think it's an important thing to do.
Yes.
You know, we talk about it with leadership, right? If you're a leader versus a manager, you have to adjust your approach to communicate with other people. Like, that's the whole point. It's not that you're ashamed of who you are, but, you know, there's certain times where you have to take consideration that person and how they're going to digest you, right? And if that can, the person that you need to present is the person that needs to be presented to get what you need out of that transaction, right?
Oh yeah.
But also, you know, understanding that our identities are often created and that they're not stagnant. But I think the complex with especially people of color, having that sort of shame of having to sort of code switch, as we call it in the Black community often, is because we're one of the only cultures that's been you know, systematically made to feel like we should be ashamed of who we are. I think that's the reason behind it.
And it's so ridiculous to me. The fact that it's named code switching specifically and whitewashing specifically for Black people. Mm-hmm. I have tons of Asian friends. Their names that they present themselves to the world as, that's not their actual name. That's not the name.
It's not their name. It's like, oh, I'm Julie. It's like, your name's not Julie. You know what I mean? But it's not called for that. Correct.
It's not called code switching when any other group does it. But the second somebody, you know, and we have to talk about, I remember when the New York Times Magazine write-up came up of you and people were like, wait, he's Black? And I'm like, he's kind of been Black. And I know that you received some backlash about that. It's like, now you're trying to be Black. How did that feel? Like, at its base, what did that feel like?
You know, as a guy who is mixed race in America, I have a tattoo about this. It's been probably one of my biggest hurdles my entire life. I was talking to my cousin the other night about it. My cousin is Black. Like, he's like blue Black. And it's funny because we grew up in the same house. His mother, a Black woman, who was my dad's sister, had a much darker husband. So he was much darker. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad, a little bit lighter than his sister, but my mother's white. Mm-hmm. I came out much lighter. We were raised in the same house. You know, he's a little older than I am. And we were talking about just how difficult that was for my sister and I being raised in a solely, exclusively Black community. My sister and I were the lightest people for miles. There was no one else. We didn't even know anyone else who was mixed race. My mother was the only white person that probably anyone in our neighborhood had ever met.
Oh, wow. You know?
So that sort of understanding of the complexity of race identity in America, I was introduced to it at a very, very young age, very abruptly. Mm-hmm. So the idea of someone having a social expectation of me depending on the color of my skin or how I project myself, to me, I sort of succumb to the fact that that's their problem, not mine. You know, I'm aware that depending on what space I'm in, I'm treated differently because of my color, right? Right. I know that. I'm very aware of that. And I know that there were certain opportunities that were presented to me because I'm lighter than other people in my family that they would never be. I know that. We talk about it openly in my family. And when I came out, it was sort of like this thing of like, oh, now you're trying to be Black. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I don't think you have to try to be what you are. It's actually, you know, as a mixed race guy, I was raised, you know, with exclusively my Black family. My mother's family were Jewish immigrants. Mm-hmm. She was born and raised in Manhattan, but I never met them. They disowned her when she was young because she, you know, problem child, you know, dating a Black guy in the late 70s, not super accepted in the Jewish community. And they were a very devout religious community in New York, like almost not Orthodox, but very close Orthodox Jews. Mm-hmm. So she was out. I never met them. So the only thing I ever knew was Black culture. It's the only thing I ever knew, right? So, and I think, again, me coming out of that environment into an environment that was exclusively white, just naturally you sort of start to evolve in this different way. Some of it was intentional. There were decisions made to survive in that environment and be successful.
Yeah.
And ultimately that becomes, I'm a sort of a culmination of my life experiences.
Right.
And it's very authentic in that way. And when you have people who, you know, you respect in the industry, especially people of color, calling you, you know, Uncle Tom, and I got called every name in the book.
Yeah.
I'm not affected by it. I really don't care. But it sort of is disappointing, especially when, you know, I feel so strongly about what people of color can contribute to our industry. And to me, it's always all love. You know, I just put my head down and work kind of guy. It was difficult to be attacked in that way.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that after that came out, you posted a picture of you like much younger with your siblings, not looking the way you look right now, like even with the beard. I'm like, oh, he's not Raj's dub. They're not twins anymore. He looks totally different now.
100%.
Did you feel in any way that like you had to put forth that image of you to kind of silence the backlash that you were getting? Did you feel like that was an important part of like almost kind of like validating? And it sounds weird to say, did you feel like as a Black man, you had to authenticate your Blackness in that moment? And did that have anything to do with it?
Yeah, it was obviously very intentional. I'd say it was more about as a mixed race Black man who is lighter skin, you do have to, because you don't just look at me and go, that is obviously a Black man. Like I could be Middle Eastern, I could be Puerto Rican, I could be, you know what I mean? It's sort of that international minority skin tone, could be almost anything. So it was that, but it also, I think there was, it was multi-layered. I think the people who were chastising me, it was almost a question of their intelligence level and that I had to give them something simple-minded for the simple-minded person to understand. Like that.
Ooh, how physical, bold is that statement? I'm here for it.
But it was like that physical social cue, like, you know, what does that say about your perception of Black people that I had to post a picture of myself as a drug dealer when I was 15 in a nightclub for you to believe that I was Black?
Yeah.
Right. So are you the problem or am I the problem? It was almost, hopefully they understood the subtlety of that. It was very intentional. And then I sort of didn't say anything else about it. I just went to work.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that like when we talked about adaptability, when we talk about the concept of adaptability, I mean, it's a form of survival. And I love that you brought that word up. It is absolutely a form of survival. And I think that, you know, there are many discussions being had, but I'm often on the minority side of an argument about like what authenticity means, particularly when it comes to race in general, because I am from Central America, purely, like traced back many, many generations back. I grew up in New York. I've never been looked at as a Latina woman, ever, right? I'm only looked at as Black, and that's fine. Yeah. I don't stay away from it. I love being Black, God knows. But your identity is often defined for you based on how you present.
Yep.
Light privilege is a thing among Black people. Like it's so layered and nuanced, so layered.
Oh, yeah.
And so as you know, like this kind of unfolded, then we had the whole MS scandal, you know, blow up. And there was particular, like it was polarizing which MSs were turning in their pins and what that meant. And you were vigilant and not. And I have to be honest, my first thought was, listen, your career and your accomplishment speaks for yourself. If you gave the pin back or you renounced the organization, what would it really mean to you? It wouldn't
affect my life at all.
Wouldn't affect your life at all. But then I think about all the other areas of the world. Like we think about things like the Oscars and the Emmys, right? Where there's one argument saying, why do you care? Why do you need this validation from it? But no one says to a football team, you guys are good. Why do you need to win the Super Bowl? Right? Everything else has a benchmark for performance where people that dedicate their lives to that, this is the culminating achievement. Mm-hmm. So on one side, I'm saying it's not going to stop his bag either way. He can give back the pin. It won't change the trajectory of his career now. And at the other side, it's like, but is it fair for me to ask somebody to give back something that they've spent their life earning? Mm-hmm. So that had to be super conflicting for you. What was your like first approach and thought when you saw other MSs start giving back their pins? Because I also do know, I think it's a privilege for you to be able to give back an accomplishment and go, fuck it, knowing that it's not going to do anything to your career.
Yeah, 100%. And look, this is the thing is, I absolutely detest performative activism. It enrages me. It does way more harm, especially if it's from a class of people who are not affected either way by, I'd say, by the injustice or by the system, to overcompensate as an ally in a performative fashion without actually ever doing anything that would ever affect any long-term change to me, it enrages me. Look, I'm a light-skinned kid, but I grew up in a very, very poor, very drug-ridden, very violent neighborhood. And, you know, I grew up in a place where I saw people often shot and killed right in front of my stoop. I understand the social constructs of America and how it does suppress and hold back people of color from the American dream. I know that. It's a fact. So when I see people who have taken no opportunity in no efforts to actually understand that, but act out in ways without fully understanding, it really, really enrages me. And that's what I saw. And I had to speak out against that. When I look at these situations, you know, my grandmother is by far the largest impact on my life in the way I see the world and everything. And in that moment, there was two phases. There was obviously the questioning of the approach to race balance in the court, but then there's also the sexual harassment scandal as well. And, you know, I do some soul searching myself, right? And I think that is, I would hope that everyone, whether you're in the court or if you're in a distributor whatever you are, you know, you do that, you know, am I doing what I can for racial equality? Am I doing what I can to respect women in the industry and hold them up and give me opportunities, things like that. And, you know, I looked at the situation with race and I said, you know, I talked to my aunt, actually, she was one of the only ones in my family members to ever go to college. And I talked to her and she says, look, Carlton, she's like, the thing was, I had to keep getting degrees because it was the only way I could prove that I was as qualified as the white guy with the corner office. And I was more qualified. And that resonated with me in the sense that I know of so many young Black sommeliers who day to day deal with the toxic environment of walking up to a table, presenting themselves as their true educated, very qualified self, and not being respected, asking for this, the real sommelier. Like these, you know, they're not microaggressions, they're aggressions, and how demoralizing that is. And a lot of them are in the court and they're studying. And I said, well, look, you know, great. So if we're going to do that, right, take the quartermaster sommeliers, everyone drop their pins, walk away. Great. What is left for them to be able to have like a certificate on the wall saying, I know this thing? Because a lot of the guys, I'd say almost all of them that dropped their pins and walked away, don't need the pin for society to trust that they know wine. They actually would believe them even if they didn't know anything about wine.
Yep.
That was my point. And to me, you know, I said, look, I would rather be a part of at least attempting to evolve this organization. Now, if the organization decides it does not want to change, then sure.
Yeah.
You know, let's build something else. But you got this infrastructure here. It's called it 75% of this thing works. This 25% is real bad. And it's about 20 years behind past due. Part of the issues we saw were a lot of the people who were running the organization were running it as a secret society type organization, but nobody else wanted that. It was a bit of a microcosm for our country's politics, how you've got the people who are running are very detached from the people who are actually in the country. And we're saying, look, we don't want that. So because it's smaller, we were able to change things quickly, get a lot of those people out of power and start moving some other people in to make some swift change. And that's sort of the trajectory it's on. And I think it's on a very good trajectory. Now, much like society, you don't make a change and you walk away. Like it has to be called out, right?
Yeah.
And people's feet have to be head to the fire to make sure that it doesn't stay consistent, that it continues to go in that direction. And more importantly, and I'd say this, and I say this to the organization is, the quartermaster sommeliers needs to evolve to adapt to what the industry and what the sommelier needs it to be, right? Not the other way around.
Correct.
Or it will go down. And rightfully so, it should. And I think the people that are in leadership now agree with that, right? And they're making really good headway. And I say why them is because I'm not on the board. Mm-hmm. I was part of a diversity committee, which, you know, to be very honest with you, put a lot of things in place that are helping to push it through. And I think they're going to do a great work. But the work continues and it always has continued. The other part was obviously the unprofessional behavior, you know, with sexual harassment, things like that. And for me, you know, to be very, very frank with you, like I went through a very, very promiscuous point in my life that, you know, is by far, you know, we learned this after therapy, a result of the environment I was raised in where, it was about hypersexuality, you know, how many women could you sleep with and that sort of thing. And that's what I was raised in. It was what I knew. When I passed master's, that didn't change, right? And I knew I had acted unprofessionally and so forth and so on. And I had to be honest about that and say, okay, great. Well, like, how do I try to, you know, better that and better myself, be a better example for that? Because, you know, to the point with my grandmother, you got to ask questions like, would my grandmother be proud of that behavior? Like, no.
Yeah.
You know, like, so it's like, great. Time to grow up, kid. You know, be an example for people who are looking up to you. And so it was on all levels. It was like, great. You know, this self-evaluation of, are you a part of the problem? If you are, fix it and help push this thing forward. But, you know, that was a really difficult time. But I think it was so necessary for the court, but also just the industry, because the court, I think it's this iconic sort of organization, but if you actually look at the actual volume sheer mass of people, it's a very small microcosm of people in the industry. So what I hope is that it does have that trickle down effect where you say, okay, great. If that organization is changing, it's this old, stale, British-based SOM organization, and hopefully that just changes it for everyone. And it's not just this flash in the plan 2020, great, we got a little bit done, that it becomes the way we operate in the industry, you know?
You just dropped so many gems. Like, I hope that people had a notepad for some of that because we begin with like what it means to, if we think about it, I went to some of the most, like, studied at some of the most racist institutions on the planet, right? If you told me now to give back my degrees, it wouldn't change anything. I have the knowledge that I have.
You got them.
Correct. Right? And I need them. I'm a Black woman, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody is like this idea of, oh, someone just took a chance on me. That almost never happens when it comes to Black people, particularly not Black women. So I concur with your aunt completely. But I think you're to be commended. And I think that we don't, you know, as we unpack and do all of this, we don't give space for growth, right? If someone had a position and then they change it, they're a flip-flopper, they're not authentic. I'm like, or they got more information, they got older, they've experienced life more, their perspectives have changed. You know, as we look at all of these instances of sexual harassment, I've always worked in very hyper-male environments, right? There are things that 29-year-old me, or let's go to 25, right? My perception of consent was very different. We were living in a different world. And so my perception of consent or vibes that you gave off or what you were asking for is very different than the positions that I hold today in 2020 at 39 years old. And I don't think, you know, I'm not at all going to excuse shit behavior, right? And you could have engaged in shit behavior. I don't think there's anything wrong with living your 20s, being kind of promiscuous as long as it's consensual. If you were going around raping people, I think that's a problem, right?
That's a big
problem.
And
so I think that, you know, unpacking that and acknowledging where even as women, right? Women shit on other women. Women have seen other women like, oh my God, she's throwing herself on him, and created an environment where if that woman came and told you tomorrow, oh my God, he raped me, you're likely to be like, girl, stop it. You were all over him too. You let, which is wrong, right? Which
it's
is
wrong.
Completely wrong.
Yeah.
But I think that we have to have more of these conversations where we give space to people admitting, like, everyone can't be aloof. This couldn't have been such a wide scale problem. And everyone's just like, what? That was happening?
No, but everyone acts that way in society.
That's horseshit.
To me, I try to look at myself, and I, again, you know, the older you get, you start realizing the impact that your parents had on you. In my case, I have one parent, I have my grandmother, and it was like, look, you know, it, would she be proud of me with that behavior? You know, yeah. And it's like, we use excuse, and I use excuse for everything. Well, it's my 20s, I'm just having fun. And yeah, you're right about that. But also, to me, it's like a personal thing. It was like, you know, what made me ashamed was, again, you know, my grandmother's passed away. I didn't act like that when she was alive. If she was around, would I present myself that way? And then also looking at a professional industry, is that professional behavior, right?
Yeah.
Very simple question. Like, you know, and it was a big wake up call for me. Mm. You know, I got called out by some friends and in a way that I was very appreciative of, to be very honest with you. And I was like, yeah, like, that's absolutely correct. And you change everything. Like, it changed the way even I interact in social environments. Like, I don't even get drunk in social environments anymore. I think it's unprofessional for me. You know, I get a little buzz, but like, you know, I used to drink and then, you know, we go out, you drink, you know, I don't do that anymore.
Right.
And I feel that as someone who, you know, wants to be an example for other people of color in the industry. And as a person of color, you're always looked at with a microscope that's a little bit more intense.
Yeah.
Is, you know, you there, that is a responsibility that comes with it. And I welcome it. You know, to me, it's another layer of challenge of, great, who's the next level of evolution, you know, for me as a person, right? Like, that's where I need to go. And that was, it was a big wake up call for me as well.
That, I mean, that's to be commended. And sometimes adaptability is that. It's adapting your thinking. It's adapting your approach to thing. I think that,
for
like,
we
see it just as this surface thing, but it's so much deeper than that. And so now, I mean, while we're talking about adaptability, let's transition to, you had a storied career, you know, in Colorado. I feel like the little Nell is, I have never been there. I have to make it there this year. Churns out some of the most consummate professionals I've ever met, like, in my life. And it's an honor to see that. And now you've adapted to your professionalism, and your role in wine is very different today from what the majority of it was. So let's talk a little bit about the transition of you leaving the dining room floor to take on very, very different roles. I remember before we actually met in person, I reached out to you like, I'm coming to Napa. I'm going to come to Heights. And it was like, no problem, right? And I think that people don't realize that there's power. Like, you could just talk to people, right? Maybe they're not standoffish. Maybe you just ask a question and be pleasant.
Correct.
So let's talk about that transition, right? You're leaving the dining room, a place that you love, you've honed your skills, you've reached the height that anybody in service could reach in that role. And now you want to do something different. Did you know what you wanted to do? Did your first role at Heights kind of fall into you?
You know, I was living in Aspen, and Aspen's obviously, it's an incredible place to live for a number of reasons. You know, between the availability to access such incredible rare wine on a regular basis and so casually, that was just a dream to work in that environment. I had built an exceptional team that I love to work with, and it was just a really, it was a very fulfilling place to be in that time and to continue that legacy. But I'm, you know, at this point I'm 35, and I'm like, okay, well, I've been here for 8 years, and you know, I'm not the type to go, okay, well, I'm just going to retire doing this thing now. And I just couldn't see myself retiring in Aspen. You know, I considered it at one point, and then I just said, no, like I've got too much in me, you know? And I always love challenge. You know, I really thrive on challenging myself. Again, when you come from a place where there is no opportunity, I think there's, you know, there's this thing where you say, I'm going to take every opportunity that can come my way or that I can create and take it as far as I can take it. Because you just know how rare it is, you know? Like, you know, I didn't come from a place where, you know, you go to high school and you just know everyone's going to college. Like, that to me, that's a very foreign concept, you know? Like, to me, it's pretty crazy. So, you know, I knew that the opportunity I had to even work in Aspen was so rare. And I took it as far as I can take it, worked very, very hard. So when this opportunity came, it was sort of, I was a little afraid, to be honest with you. It was so out of my comfort zone. What I realized was that although, you know, I feel like my knowledge level was very advanced with wine in general, this is a different industry. And there was so much I didn't know. And, you know, I was very honest with the Lawrence family when we had the initial conversation. Was I literally just wrote them a list of everything that I could not do the job. And I think he was, you know, Galen was a little caught off guard initially by that, by me just being blatant and honest. There was two things. One, I didn't want to misrepresent myself, and I didn't want to lie to him. And then two, he was a friend, and I didn't want him to feel like I was trying to manipulate him. So, you know, he was looking for someone that believed in what Heights could be and what it should be in the world and had an idea of where it needs to be and how to get it there. But, you know, he's a really smart guy. He's run a lot of different businesses and a lot of different types of industries. And he really sort of walked me down a path of pretty much saying, hey, look, this is why I feel you're the right person for the job. You'll learn these things. You're very quick learner. He's like, I can tell you'll learn these quickly, but this core thing that you have here is what you need to be successful here. And, you know, I think we both took a leap of faith with each other. And my first transition period was one of the hardest times in my life. I was working full-time at the Lonell and full-time at Heights, commuting every week between Napa and Aspen. Yeah, it was nuts. So I would work in Aspen Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then first thing Monday morning, I would take the 7 a.m. flight from Aspen direct to SFO, get in the rental car, drive straight to Heights, meet. And then Thursday morning, take the SFO Aspen direct, land, go straight to the Nell. If you can look at that, there's no days off. I didn't take a day off for 4 months. And I pretty much just went back and forth. I had three suitcases open and I just bought 25 of the same dress shirt and a bunch of the same pants and everything. And I literally just packed them. And I would take a whole suitcase to the dry cleaner and just tell them, just
give this back,
clean everything and fold it, put it back in the suitcase. And that's how I lived like 4 months. And I moved in the middle of that, you know, but in that time we were able to do two things. Transition the Nell to the new wine director, Chris Dunaway, and keep that going so that wasn't interrupted. The guests never even felt an interruption while still now trying to reconceptualize what the future of Heights was. We were doing it both at the same time. So it was nuts. But during that time, I think it proved to the family that I was capable of taking an enormous amount of stress, staying level-headed and seeing it through, which is, you know, during my time here, looking at everything we've had to overcome, you know, since I got here, it's proven to be probably the greatest asset is the ability to adjust, evolve, adapt, and stay pretty level-headed, you know?
That's so dope. And the vulnerability of being able to say that, like, I can't do everything, you know, like there is some shit I just can't do. I can learn it, you know, and that's kind of like the cosmos colliding and like you having a level of confidence and assuredness, but also knowing what your actual weaknesses are. You know, like even as you interview people, I hate when people cannot come up with a weakness. I'm like, well, then you're not very self-aware because you know that you're not good at something, right? Like there's no way.
You have to. I mean, I do all the time.
You have to know it. Listen, we would be on this podcast for 2 hours if I started going over the list of weaknesses I have, but it's somebody seeing in you kind of what you can be and what the overwhelming talents of like, I can't teach you the things that you naturally have. I can teach you the things that you don't have. That's really where building and cultivation and development starts. And it's a great transition into the Roots Fund, right? Because one of the things that I wanted to talk about too is like, you know, like you've seen the court, you've seen what it's been, you recognize that, you know, the opportunities that you had are crazy. But to the young professional now that, okay, wine finally seems approachable, if not approachable necessarily, but for the purposes of that statement. But wine seems like a career that is not far-fetched anymore. It's something actually tangible. And you know what it's like to be in a position of management, of leadership. You know how people in very fine, high-end places are looking to hire and all of that. I'm sure there's no shortage of people that have reached out to you for advice, for mentorship, for all that. How did it go from like people one-off reaching out to you to now you realizing like, no, this has to be something bigger. Like there needs to be a way for me to contribute the experiences and talents and relationships that I've built to really open up the space for others. So let's talk a little about creation of the Roots Fund.
Yeah. So it really was birthed out of, you know, when everything was happening with the court, again, that sort of part of that self exploration was asking the question to myself of, you know, I've been able to work very hard in both create and be presented with a lot of opportunities to put me in a place where, you know, I can start to inspire other people. And I said, well, have I done enough or made enough efforts to create those opportunities for other people that come from places where I'm from, that look like me? You know, have I done enough or am I just sort of head down just working?
Yeah.
And for the most part, I had been, but I said, you know what? Like, it's time to look at what I can do. And I don't know what that is, but let's start to explore it. And I actually, you know, I got on a phone with Tahira because I knew she had the Hughes Society. I was talking about what she was doing. And you know, I ultimately came down to trying to define what were the barriers to entry. You know, like that was like the first thing is like, what's keeping people of color from gaining access to the wine industry as a career path. And I really would just like, I do a lot of my planning on a dry erase
whiteboard.
And I just sort of like, I like whiteboard everything. So I just like whiteboarding like things like it's, a, you know, these cultural, these economic, you know, sort of like looking through all these things. And then I realized, you know, very quickly, I said, look, I don't know how to start a nonprofit. I mean, I can Google, I can figure out, I don't have time to do it.
Yeah.
Most importantly. So I called my friend Akemi DuBose, and she's an old friend of mine, also a recipient of a scholarship from CCAP. She went to Johnson & Wales, which is a really incredible cook. And she had done some work for nonprofits, and I called her for advice, which turned into her, you know, saying, hey, look, can you come help with this thing? And then, so pretty much it was myself, Tahir, and Akemi sort of as a think tank to say, all right, like, what are the issues and how do we solve them? Like, and not like BS, like really do it. Now, that said, there were already other organizations that were doing great work and continue to do great work. And we were very, very far from the first, and hopefully we were very far from the last. But our idea was that we didn't have anything here that was really based in California, especially in Napa. And it was more of like a divide and conquer thing. Like, you know, those organizations are doing such great work, but like I'm here in Napa, it's sort of like this hub. Can we do something here? Because there's so many impactful people here where hopefully all together these efforts could culminate into something that's very, very impactful. It was never meant to either compete with them or try to create something that was even saying, like, well, they don't do this, so I'll do this. It was just, let's all do these things, build together, support each other as much as possible. And we came up with the concept that first it was education, that after so many generations of not being accepted into certain parts of social classes in society, there's certain career paths that you don't really, you're not aware that they're actually career paths. And so we say, hey, look, how do we educate people of color? This is actually a really great career path. And there are actually multiple ways you can enter the industry. right? Everything from viticulture all the way through distribution, retail, everything, right? Media, I mean, there's so much in the wine industry. It's huge. So just trying to expose people to what all the possibilities are. Once they decide what they want to do, trying to offer them scholarships or opportunities, whether it be schooling, certifications, mentorship programs, things like that, just to give them the resources to get the education and qualifications needed to excel in that path as much as we can.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, look, you just need to connect them with someone that can help. Mm-hmm. That pretty much sometimes that's it. And then there's you know, job placement. So in the cases of people going through the program, well, you know, one thing that we have to succumb to and understand is that in most industries, jobs are often filled before they're even listed.
Yes.
A friend of a friend. Do you know a guy?
Somebody sort of knows thing. Someone. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's not malicious. It's just how people fill jobs often. Not in like huge corporations, but like in especially in mid-sized companies.
Even in huge ones. It's that sometimes. Oh, yeah, great.
Especially at the
top. It's that you know someone. Absolutely.
So if you're pushed out of a social circuit due to race and class, then how would you ever even be considered for that job? So we say, it's like, how do we use our influence in the industry to get them in the room for the interview? That's sort of the third tier, which is like helping with job placement. So we looked at that and said, look, if we can sort of try to champion these three tiers, which is sort of exposure and awareness, you know, education, and then job placement, then we can make a really impact. Because ultimately, I said, the real measure of if the efforts are successful is if you have Black and brown people in the jobs. Right. Like I love seeing Black and brown people engaging with wine, buying wine as a consumer. But my question is either employed in the jobs or creating companies, right? Employing themselves. Right. Either way, in the industry, that's the measure of success. And that's what we're sort of, you know, working on right now. Obviously, moving forward, Akemi has taken the role as executive director. She's running it. Myself, Tahira, and now Jeremy Sace are on the board. And we're now adding more board members as we move along. And it's been a really incredible journey for all of us. Very fulfilling as well. And it's just great to be able to sort of reciprocate opportunity that was given to me. And I know how that feels to not have it.
Yeah.
And then someone say, hey, no, come over here. We can help you with this thing. And it really makes you feel valued.
Yeah.
It makes you feel seen and heard. And those things are incredibly important.
I think that third tier particularly is always the component, because even when we look at it, you know, at one point, our barrier and most minority cultures, women of any color, anything, the barrier has always been the easiest barrier to see. The most obvious one is always education, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just like everyone got a bachelor's degree, right? Opportunities open up. Everyone got a bachelor's degree. People were still jobless, right? So the education is one part, but if I can't go and get hired somewhere and my success in this field is predicated on me having some experience, if that loop isn't being, and whether or not we ever actually close it, probably, you know, that will be the goal. But as long as that loop is recognized and things are being plugged in to fill that, you know, I'm following the people that are actually in Burgundy. Like, I don't think Burgundy has ever seen this many Black people there ever.
No.
Like,
no, I talked to Akemi. She said, these people look at me like I got three heads. It's amazing. She's like walking around. You know, she's got the big, big curly hair.
Yes.
And she's walking out. She's big red lipstick. But she's like, look, it's been really incredible because I think, you know, one, they felt incredibly embraced, which makes me very happy. But, you know, it's very clear to see when, you know, people have never really been around Black people before.
Yes.
It's like, they're just very, very curious. They're like, wow, like, you know, and it's sort of funny. You sort of sit back and laugh, you know, and I'm going back and forth with like Darren and George and all these guys. And I'm like, it's sort of funny, but it's so cool at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, looking at the domains that have really embraced it in Burgundy, it just reminds you what an awesome industry it is, you know? And look, there's shitty people in every industry, right?
Absolutely.
But there's so many good people in the wine industry, and it's such a fulfilling industry. I agree. It's like
you
the
love
Mecca
to see it.
Yeah, it's very funny.
It's so good, and you can see like joy, particularly like shout out to George. I love George. George is like my little brother.
He's so
but
funny.
There is so much like pure joy resonating. If you don't follow George Walker and you're listening to this, you absolutely should. But to see like I'm like George is blackety black, like locks.
Yeah. Oh
like,
yeah.
And he is just being embraced. He's at you know, the bakery in the morning. He's perfecting his front. Like, it's just a, it, it's just a, like, you have to look at it like, why did this take so long? Like, that's indicative. That's not just wine. That's the world, right? Why do we still have first Black or first female, or why are there still first of anything? Right. Yeah. But we are still an evolving world, but I love seeing it.
But I think, you know, the world is dealing with the fact that, it's, you know, I'm traveling for this show right now. And, you know, I've been able to sort of go all around the world, even the last, you know, 5 months, you start realizing that the blinders have been taken off the entire world. It's all a result of George Floyd.
Yeah.
And not to just distill it down to that, but it really is that situation and moving into the BLM movement has had an impact on the world that will change things forever. You know, the veil has been taken back, which naturally has created this big sort of anti-awareness movement of people who are really fighting the exposure of, you know, the impact of colonialism around the world, and essentially how maybe some of your favorite countries are completely based solely on racism to this day.
Yeah.
And I don't think we sort of can't go back from now. It's like sort of once you see something, you can't unsee it. And, you know, people are aware now and it's changing. They're starting to realize that there has been a very intentional campaign to associate people of color with being more impoverished and lower class and uneducated and so forth. And that has led to, I think, a lot of issues with employment and so forth. It's just people's perception of a person of color even being capable, you know, on a level of intelligence to do the job. And that, you know, this is deep rooted from, you know, a couple thousand years.
Yeah.
Let's call it definitely at least the last 700 years of a misinformation marketing campaign internationally to conveniently brand people of color as being lesser class to benefit the structure of colonialism, and to feed funds and capital into about 6 countries in Europe and then now America.
Yep.
So this is a fact, and the world is now opening their eyes and coping with it. And you sort of can't go back from here. Mm-hmm. So with that comes of this big explosion of nationalist movements that essentially nationalism is racism.
Of course it is.
They're synonymous. And with that also, you start to see within these demographics, some amazing people that are saying, nope, actually, we're not doing that. You know, I love listening to, you know, Jeremy says is so outspoken against it.
I love him.
It's just made me I've always loved him. I've always loved his wines. I love his family. But it puts it up on a pedestal where it's like DRC who, in my opinion, because, you know, great, your wines are good, but what are you doing for humanity?
Yeah.
I don't care if you can make great wines, right? DRC makes great wines. Who cares? To me, I'm putting my money in Dujac's pocket because I believe in what they stand for as a company. Yeah. You know, what we're doing here is like, great, you know, I know you guys can make great wine, but what are we doing for our community and for humanity? And, you know, we challenge each one of our wineries to contribute to 1 to 2 nonprofits. It's like, you got to stand for more than just making wine. It's difficult. But that's the basis of our business. And being able to see people like Jeremy and I know, you know, Etienne, you know, he's brought in George over there, that because that veil's been removed, there's some people who are just saying, yeah, you're right. My country did that. That was screwed up. Let's fix it. Let's move forward.
Yeah.
And I think it's awesome. I think, again, this will continue. It won't ever go backwards.
Yeah. And it's the people that are positioned to do it, right? And I think that with great prestige and power comes responsibility. And I think that I couldn't agree more that that's where we are, where you can continue to do things exactly the way you've always done it. And there will be people that have no problem with that, that actually want you to keep doing that.
Correct.
But we don't have to fund it, right? Like the world of wine is large enough where you can selectively choose, okay, if that's your position, I allow you to do that, but I won't be complicit in it. And man, I feel like we need, now you're the busiest person ever, so I don't know how I would do it, but I feel like we need like a 3-part series. Like, we haven't even talked wine.
I know.
But no, I think that this was such a rich conversation that people, I think that it's easy to look at something or someone and go, okay, I see this, 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 it equals this. And I think that you above a lot of other people, I think that there's this misconception of who and what you are. And it's because you're relatively, you know, quiet, you know.
I don't talk to a lot of people. I go home.
And I get, but that silence, you know what I mean? I feel like sometimes that silence just opens up space for people to like fill in their own blanks. I'm like, oh, but.
Happens all the time.
Maybe you actually talk to him and see it. Mm-hmm. And this has been such like an enlightening and eye-opening. And I cannot believe how quickly an hour has flown by. It's making me sad how quickly it is, because we've got to talk. We're going to have to do another one where we actually talk about wines and stuff.
Yeah.
But this was a necessary. It was so, you know, I think that what you said is so true. Like, there is no going back from this. Mm-hmm. And we'll really see the truth in people and how they move forward. We'll see who is a true ally. You know, half of Europe, they'll tell you they don't hate Black people. Look at our soccer team, right? How many European national soccer teams have no Black people? The only one I can actually think is not in Europe. No, I can't think of a single European, major European wine producing team that doesn't have a shit ton of Black people, Black superstars on their national team.
I just went and filmed in Paris, and that was, we discussed that, which was the idea that much like you did in America, it's like, you know, as long as you're entertaining me and representing my city or my country and you're winning, I love you. But the moment you speak about an issue with your country, you know, that's unacceptable. You can't kneel peacefully.
Nope.
You know,
shut up and kick a ball.
Correct. Because it's again, that is that idea of, you know, we don't, you know, you're not French. You're African. You'll never be French. French are white people, right? It's that convenient perception of national identity, which is an illusion. You know, Paris is probably one of the most racist cities in the world.
Yep.
By far.
So is New York, truthfully.
Oh yeah.
New York is extremely racist.
Big time. I grew up in D.C.
It's a liberal racist bubble.
It is completely separated. Chicago, absolutely. Completely separated.
Absolutely.
These are Jim Crow cities to this day. And you don't have to have it in you know, legal. It's in social structures. You figure out how to do it with redlining, you know, it's just like in Paris. In France, it's illegal to be racist. It's actually illegal to be racist. What it does is it means that no one actually, there's no paper trail for it. And you're actually not allowed to talk about it. And we ask the question is, if you're not talking about race, is it because you want to ignore racism? And that makes them very uncomfortable. Americans, we get used to talking about things. They don't talk about things there. You know?
Even here, if you think about it, you know, like I saw a great like meme of critical race theory where it's like, imagine a world where your grandparents and great-grandparents were so racist that they don't want their great-grandchildren to learn about how racist they were.
Yeah,
and
but also like if
so powerful.
Correct. But also, like, at what point are you saying, okay, great. So if you don't actually want your children to learn about the history of the country, what makes this different than North Korea, right? It's just communist propaganda.
Absolutely. Where everything's fine. Everything's
fine. So it's not history. Don't call it history. Call it a fairy tale. Call it what you want. Just don't call it history because it's not, right?
Nope.
And it's ultimately what it came back to was I had to make the decision was I just going to stay quiet, keep working, allow the issues that I see that have affected me and my family to just sort of, well, I don't want to ruffle any feathers. I'll just be quiet and sort of do my job. Or were you going to sort of speak about it and approach it, but in a way that actually was going to be productive, make some change and affect things and be an example on how to engage in a way to make change instead of just running around yelling. And that was the decision. It was like, if given the chance to have an impact on the world, like, why wouldn't you? You know, like, I think frankly, it makes you a bad person to choose not to.
Yeah.
And that's where the line, unfortunately, has to be drawn is if you have the opportunity to and you choose not to, it literally makes you a bad person.
It does. And we have to call it what it is. Damn, I can't believe an hour is gone, guys. Like, I'm like, we haven't talked about the family reunion. You're going to have to come back. We have a lot more to talk about.
Yeah,
but
we can
do
it.
I think that this conversation was so, like, I hope that you guys, like, I am further energized. I am invigorated. I am inspired, which is something that you've always been to me. And like navigating identity, navigating respectability politics, and sometimes going, you are going to categorize me the way you're going to characterize me. That's going to be a you issue and not a me issue. I'm going to keep living.
I started doing it. I started taking it off myself. I was like, I got nothing to do with that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care. And then two, I can't spend my time walking around worried about how people, you know, perceive me. Now, if I've done something wrong, I got to admit it. I got to fix it, right? That's number one.
Yeah.
But if, you know, I'm going about and I feel I'm doing the right thing, I'm being my best self and I'm presenting myself to the world the way it's my authentic self, that yeah. I have decided, because only I will decide who I am.
Yeah.
Right. You don't get to decide how I express my blackness. You don't get to express how I express any of it. Yes. I decide that for myself because it's my life and I get one of these, right? So I'm going to live the life that I want to live. Then I really can't be concerned with what you feel about me. Now, you talk about the inspiration thing. It's important to talk inspiration is, it doesn't move linear. It's a circle thing. And I think, for me, I work a lot, but I watch a lot as well. And, I have employees that inspire me. And I think, one thing that is so important is representation in its basic human psychology. And I think, you leading this podcast, this agenda, I think is so important for people to see. I mean, because this super intelligent, really professional black woman that is like leading this charge and agenda, I mean, it means an enormous amount for people. I think that we both are similar ages where we didn't see anyone of color doing anything that we had aspired to do. So you sort of had to pioneer a lot of things. And not that you were even the first pioneer, but look, even if you're at the first, if you're the second, third, 10th, you're still in pioneering mode. And I feel that we have a different weight on our shoulders breaking through these things that, I just feel like it's a blessing. And I'm sure you feel the same way.
Sure.
To be in a situation where just us doing the thing that we love has this impact through representation to inspire them to say, look, if they did this, I can do this.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you've been able to do with the show. And I think it's really awesome to see. And what I love most is you do it matter-of-factly and without needing other people's approval, which is the way it should be.
I appreciate you. You're so right. Like, immigrant kid, I wanted to cook. My parents found that to be the most laughable. Like, there was no way that they moved to America for me to go and cook. So that was not, but in my heart of hearts, like that cooking as a cultural thing, it is the center of my life with my family. And so I always knew that somehow, some way, food and wine would be a part of me. I didn't know how, not wine. Like, wine was like the later thing. I'm a rum culture person, but somehow, some way though, this part of my life that was so essential. And so as soon as the opportunity that I didn't even know existed and in a way created for myself, I felt a responsibility to go with it. Now your life is exhausting. I am transparent about that. I'm like, I am tired all the time.
I am tired all the time as well.
I have a full career completely unrelated to this. Like, I am always tired. But there is so much value in a simple DM or an email. Like, I love listening to that episode. I feel you, girl. You know what I mean? Like, just to know that someone hearing you and I just talk the way nobody could be listening to this conversation. It'd be the exact same way. Mm-hmm. And to see that people are finding value of that. People are hearing themselves. People are hearing references and verbiage and vocabulary that before this wine thing didn't make sense to them, but hearing it from you makes it make sense. That's all the fulfillment I need. That makes everything,
it's huge.
It fuels me to keep going.
It's huge. But also what it does for people who may have never, to be honest with you, because of social constraints, they may have never even interacted with a black woman before.
True.
Or maybe the only one they saw was, someone they see who's a rapper, a pop star, or someone that the news wants to project as a negative influence on television. Maybe they never interacted with a really intelligent, professional black woman before in their lives. And they go, wow, and that changes their perception.
I'm so much fun. Like, come hang out with me. I'm super fun. All right. We have to play this little game. Even though we didn't get into wine, we have to play this little game at the end.
Okay.
So you're exhausted and everything that could have possibly happened in a day goes absolutely shitty. Mm-hmm. Nothing's going well. What do you drink when you get home?
You know what? This is really interesting especially now what I do for a living, I drink wine in a way that I overanalyze wine. Mm-hmm. I definitely did before this, but now it's even worse because I understand the production of wine and farming. I don't drink wine when I come home. I really do.
What is it?
If we have dinner parties and things like that, for sure. There's two things. It depends on how bad the day was. So, sort of normal. Okay, that was not a great day. That was tough. Tomorrow might be tougher. What I do is I drink. I like Trumer pills. I like pills, ice cold, because it's like one step above the really really cheap beers. It's just like one step. Like, I'm sort of aged out of the Bud Light thing, and I still, if it's around, I'll
drink
it.
We can't drink Bud Light.
It's just one notch above. But I like super cold beer. Like I'm talking, like I can't drink just like cold beer. I put it in the freezer.
Ice cold beer.
So I do is I come home, I put it in the freezer, I get undressed, I turn the shower on, I take a hot shower and I come out and I just, I'm standing in the kitchen, I drink the whole beer, just ice cold. Like you just have to, what it does, between the hot shower, it just sort of rinses away the day. And you're like,
got it.
It's like the big, like, it's like you inhale beer in and then breathe out. It's like this super meditative thing. And if it's been really, really bad, tumbler, ice, tequila, just straight.
Oh, just straight tequila. Up. Tequila
just
it is.
Just Blanco, like silver tequila. My, you know, my buddies own Lobos tequila. So they keep me stocked. Like I got a box of tequila in my living room. So I just like
jeez, ice, Louise.
Silver, Lobos, and just like, just drink ice cold silver tequila because it's like I need it faster. You know, like I need the buzz faster.
That's what I'm saying. On bad, bad days. All right. Polar opposite. Day goes really freaking well. Things that you expected to go to shit actually didn't. They were great. Now what do you drink?
You know, I when I come home sometimes when I have a great day, I know this is weird. Sometimes I don't drink at all.
Okay.
And but what I tell you what I love to do is I have a good day. I love going and going to different places to get specialty foods. And I cook a really ornate dinner because it, to me, it's like, it's nothing more special than that. And typically Maya will open a bottle of wine. She's born and raised in the wine. I'd say 10 times out of 10, she's the one who instigates the bottle. She comes over and grabs the bottle, opens it. And it's always really good. And then I'll have a little glass with her. She drinks a lot more wine than I do. And, but I love cooking like a beautiful ornate meal. And it just makes me feel good. It's like, I had a great day. I'm going to go in and like buy those lamb chops that are probably too expensive, but I'm just going to buy
too expensive.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm going to buy this special ingredient or whatever. And it's sort of like a little celebration for myself. Cause I go right, you know, I all day I'm going to wineries, taste wine anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm already doing it anyway. So she'll open some, I have a little taste of something, but to me, a great day. I just love cooking. Like a really beautiful dinner.
I can relate to that. Cooking is so cathartic in me. Yeah. I'm like, I go out to eat so much because if I had to cook the things that I really want to eat on any given day, it would cost me way more than paying a restaurant to cook it for me. That is awesome. So now I do have a wine question for you. And this is a fun one, especially not only because of all the things you've drank, but now you're into production. If there is a grape that can go away, never ever to be grown or vinified again on the planet, what is it?
Torrontés.
Well, yes,
I'm not
agree.
Sure. I'm not sure why it exists right now. I just don't get it. Every time I try it, and I'm a very open-minded. Like, I hate when people are just like, oh, I don't drink that. You know, your psalm's like, I don't have Malbec. I'm like, actually, if you have some high elevation stuff from the Uco Valley, like those wines are fire. You know, like go have like Zorzal's, like Ego, or I mean, there's so many good ones now. So, but it's like, every time I have that wine, I'm like, I try so hard and I just don't get it. I've had the best in class, the worst. Actually, sometimes the cheaper versions of wines are better because they don't overcompensate depending on the region. But I just don't get it. I'm just like, look, this place, you could grow so many other better things. And I don't get it.
It's so perfumey. Yeah. I mean, I have the same, everyone knows I have the same kind of relationship with Viognier. I am coming around to Viognier. I just don't understand.
I like to smell it more than drink it. Like Grape Condru, I love smelling. It's intoxicating to smell. It's
but look
crazy.
How much you have to pay for it. That's where to get good expressions of Viognier, I feel like I have to spend a shit ton of money and I don't want that. Now,
super
I've had some good ones from Israel though that have kind of changed my mind about it. But that has always been my issue with it. It's like, this is not that great. I would rather drink Semillon. Personally, and to
I love
get
Semillon.
An expression, me too. So
Semillon,
to get an expression of Viognier that I like, I'm like, I don't want to spend this much. I could drink a better, something that I enjoy more for less money. So I don't hate it. I just don't get it personally.
I don't get
it.
Nah,
I hate it a little
bit. Yeah. Like to me, there's so few Viognier plantings around the world. Like some of the more reputable ones. Again, I don't need a ton of acid. I like acid in wine. But it just, the Viognier is that I drink, even if they're Condrus, I love the aromatics of them, but they just fall so flat on the palate.
They're flat.
They need a lot of age, right? Like, and again, who's drinking a ton of like old Condru? It's like, they're just not a lot on the market anyway. But I just don't get it.
We've added that one to the... Oh my God, this was so good. So before we wrap this, you've got to tell everyone. Yeah. I don't know who's listening to this podcast that isn't following you. But if they're not following you, how do people follow you on social media?
Sure, sure. I've more recently tried to be more active, which I'm not very good at. It's at Carlton McCoy, but on Twitter and Instagram. I typically post on Instagram, but occasionally, because I like dad jokes and puns, I would just post something on Twitter once in a while. And then sometimes I'd delete it.
Dude, I'm dad like, jokes oh, are the best. Oh, no, yeah. Don't
I'm
delete
like, oh,
them.
That was goofy. I'm like, oh, that was goofy. oh, God. That's
goofy. No, dad jokes are great. I'm fine. I'm 39. Yeah. I'm 39 and I like dad jokes. I'm okay with it. Yeah, oh my goodness. Well, we're going to have to bring you back, but thank you so much for amazing conversation. You guys can't see me, but you hear me smiling because I think this was just so great. When you're listening to this, go back, listen again, get your notepad because so many gems were dropped. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you. Cheers.
And until next week, guys, cheers. Oh my goodness, guys, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. We are offering a special gift to all of my amazing listeners. If you haven't subscribed yet, head on over to SomTV.com. Right now, if you enter the code Shakera, S-H-A-K-E-R-A, you will get 50% off your annual membership. And so that makes sure you don't miss any of the amazing content, including a couple things that feature me, on SomTV. Head on over to SomTV.com, use code Shakera, and sign up for your yearly subscription now. We'll be right back.